Michael Tellinger with us live in South Africa. We're going there in a moment to talk about vanishing civilizations and some of his additional work when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Michael Tellinger with us, author, scientist, explorer, humanitarian, who has become a real-life Indiana Jones character, making groundbreaking discoveries about advanced vanished civilizations at the southern tip of Africa. He continued analytical scientific approaches, has produced stunning new evidence that will force a lot of us to rethink our origins and rewrite our history books. Michael exposed the vanished civilization at the southern tip of Africa that left behind more than 10 million stone ruins. He's also a noted author, including Slave Species of the Gods. Michael, welcome back, my friend. How you been?
Excellent, George. Nice to hear your voice again, and welcome. Hello to all your listeners.
They say that the new variant, Omicron, developed in South Africa. I'm not so sure that's where it really started. What's going on out there?
What is very clear to us in South Africa now is, please understand that we used to be one of the most advanced countries in the world until, the ANC took over our government, if not the most advanced technologically, medically, and nuclear and all that stuff. So the labs that we have in this country are first class, world class. So when we discover a new strand, you realize that it's real. But at the same time, the new strand was identified and said, oh, look, there's something interesting that's evolving here. But it wasn't there was no information put out about how deadly it is or anything like that. That was just created and picked up by the global media. Suddenly, South Africa was the place that this new variant emerged from. It's got nothing to do with it. That variant has been found in the USA. It's been found all over the place. But I think what's happening here, because South Africa's constitution is very, very advanced. It's often said that we have one of the strongest and most humanitarian constitutions in the world. Because of Nelson Mandela's release from prison, so he was mostly the architect and the author of the Constitution. So it is very, very pro freedom and human liberty. So our Constitution does not permit or allow any kind of lockdowns, masks, vaccinations, mandates. None of that is allowed. So what is going on in South Africa right now is completely and utterly unconstitutional and should not be happening. In fact, there's a new constitutional court case starting in about a week, and it looks like the government is going to lose. Well, they have to lose because the constitution stipulates it very clearly. But because of this, and because our president, when he got his marching orders from the global elite and the WHO, World Health Organization, because he hasn't been able to enforce vaccines to get like 70-80% people vaccinated, they're now punishing South Africa. So that's what it seems like. We've been punished for not complying with the directive of the World Health Organization. That's just my take and millions of other South Africans' take on this.
And what's the incident of COVID in South Africa, Michael? Is it up or down?
Oh, it's nothing. It's nothing. Again, we got to distinguish between cases. A case means you could. They can claim that you have the virus with a PCR test that is completely inaccurate in any case, or so it means nothing. So it's how many deaths there are. So the death rate is very, very low. I mean, hardly anyone is dying of COVID here. It's they die of other things, not of COVID. So Africa, as you may know, is the least affected continent in the world. Like 10% or something like that of COVID, so-called COVID deaths have been found in Africa compared to other parts of the world. So I think they're trying to punish Africa and especially South Africa because, if you punish South Africa, then you punish the rest of the continent. It's a mess. It's a bloody mess. And I must tell you that South Africans are just getting so, as we call it, a gutful. Like really sick and tired of this nonsense, and I think there's going to be huge pushback from the population. And I think this constitutional court case that's about to start is going to create huge waves. Obviously, the mainstream media is not talking about it at all.
Not at all. Well, let's talk about some vanishing civilizations and some of your work. What have you been up to lately?
Oh, George, The biggest discoveries now are in the technology, unquestionably. The fossils, obviously, I keep finding and discovering more fossils and more giant body parts and more scratch marks, claw marks, teeth marks, skin, fossilized petrified skin of large creatures, going up to 300 meters, what is that, 1,000 feet.
Wow.
Small ones, small giants, large giants, all various sizes of giants, all kinds of reptilian teeth, hearts, lungs, all kinds of claws, hooves, etc., etc. So my museum keeps expanding and growing. But the big thing really is our rapid expansion in starting to truly understand ancient advanced technology. And that really gives me the most joy at the moment, where we're truly getting to come into grips with what they used and how they used it, and showing the evidence of the fact that this is actually advanced technology. It's not just a bunch of stones.
And let's talk about some of these ruins. How did you come across this story?
Well, the people that have been listening to your show and people that watch my website and my videos will be aware of this. For those that are new, welcome. This is, in my opinion, probably and possibly one of the biggest stories in archaeology in the last 100 years. Because we've uncovered, or I have uncovered, I guess I can say that, the largest vanished civilization that's ever been uncovered on Earth, because more than, as you mentioned in your introduction, there are more than 10 million of these stone circle ruins in southern Africa, which really between South Africa and Zimbabwe mostly, which is just north of us, and then some of it is in Botswana, which is sort of northwest of us, and some of it is Mozambique to the east and north of us, but mostly South Africa and Zimbabwe. And so the stone circle ruins have been, the awareness of them goes back 500 years.
Jeez.
When the Portuguese first came around the Cape of Good Hope on the way to India and the east. Cape of Good Hope is known as Cape Town. So when they came around the Cape of Good Hope and they landed up on the shores of what is today Mozambique and South Africa and that part, the Indian Ocean, and they asked the local tribes, when they met the local tribes, this was in the late 1400s, early 1500s. It's 500 years ago. And they found some of these ancient ruins. They went all the way up to Great Zimbabwe. And when they asked the local tribes that they encountered who built these structures, they were told, we didn't build them. We're just occupying them. That's how far back the awareness of these stone circles go. And then nothing happened until the rediscovery of Great Zimbabwe in 1876, when I think it was an American that was there somewhere in Great Zimbabwe, and he brought a German archaeologist or German explorer called Karl Mauch, and he showed him the Great Zimbabwe ruins. So when Great Zimbabwe was shown to the Europeans in around 1876, that then created a wave of interest in these stone circle structures and these stone circle ruins in southern Africa. And then brought a host of explorers and aristocratic explorations. You can imagine in those days, the only people that could go and explore these far and distant exotic lands were the wealthy aristocrats from Europe. That's it.
Right. It wasn't
as if it was humanitarian, or it was all, let's go and find some treasure, discover some exciting places, see what lands we can conquer, and see how much stuff we can loot and bring back for our personal collection that we can sell and for the museums. So we've got to put things into context here.
Michael, what would you say would be the significance of the stone ruins?
Well, the significance, in my opinion, is that they tell us that there was a huge vanished civilization here. And this went on thousands and thousands of years. So there are a number of significant points. First of all, it tells us that this civilization goes back 300,000 years. Okay,
wow.
Pay attention to this number. I'm not saying 3,000 or 30,000. I'm saying 300,000 thousand years. And I'll share some evidence with you how I can be so confident about this. And this evidence I'm referring to now is actually relatively new. I only really got this evidence in January 2020, just before the lockdown nonsense hit us. So we firstly were dealing, the significance is that we're dealing with an incredibly old civilization. The next significant thing is that we're dealing with the vastness of it, the sheer numbers of these ruins, 10 million or more. The next point of significance is that it exposed the ancient advanced technology, the tools, the technological tools that I've collected for my museum, that in my museum for everyone to see, and out in the mountains, still they cover the mountains. The technology is actually lying on the land as well. And I'll go more into that if you want to go in that direction.
Yeah, please. I'd love to hear. We've got some time. Go ahead.
Yeah, so just finish the significant points. And then the fact that the stone circles themselves are energy-generating devices, so that they weren't dwellings for people or animals, that they were actually built with no doors and entrances, and that every stone circle generates energy, generates sound frequencies. Those sound frequencies that move through the walls create magnetic fields, and those moving magnetic fields obviously create electromagnetic fields. So this is very advanced knowledge of the use of sound, resonance, and frequency. And the other significant thing is that all of this activity points to the presence and the work of the Anunnaki. Enki and his gold mining clan that came down here to Southern Africa mining gold. You know all about it. Anyone that studied or read Zachariah Sitchin.
Right.
And then read Anton Parks more recently, all his brilliant works, talks in great detail about the mining of gold, the obsession with gold, and this place called the Abzu that they refer to, which seems to be Zimbabwe and South Africa. And they found huge amounts of gold here. And the evidence that I'm finding more and more, almost on a weekly and a monthly basis, of more ancient gold mines is just staggering.
Are they still mining for gold down there now, Michael?
Gold, yes and no. Or no and yes. First of all, we have very good intelligence from very advanced photographic and ground-penetrating radar technology that has been shared with me over the last 10 years. We have very strong visual indicators of underground tunnels. And when I say underground tunnels, I don't mean just one or two. I'm talking hundreds of underground tunnels that seem to contain loads, tons and tons of gold in each tunnel, and tons from 100 tons to a few thousand tons of gold. So, yes, there seems to be gold lying, processed gold, mined processed gold lying in these tunnels underground. They're very difficult to get to, and there also seems to be some sort of an energetic distortion when you dig to find these tunnels. And I speak from experience. We've spent a lot of time and money and effort to try and find one of the most accessible tunnels, and it became very difficult. If you don't know how to dig tunnels, if you don't have an engineering background, if you don't have the right tools and equipment, it's very, very difficult. And it's very, very expensive. That's the next thing. So anyone thinks they're going to go dig the tunnels and get the gold out, you know, you have another thing coming. It's not as simple as that.
Are these extraterrestrials we're talking about, or humans with incredible technology?
These, at this stage, it's all pointing to the Anunnaki. So, you know, call them extraterrestrials,
right,
or other dimensional beings. It all depends to what you subscribe, what space is at the moment. You know, I'm beginning to think more and more that space is actually just a different dimension. That may be what NASA has been showing us and the sci-fi movies have been showing us about space may not necessarily be true. That space is actually just different dimensions. So that's a whole very another interesting discussion, by the way.
Michael, you discovered some kind of cone-shaped tool. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's really critical. And I guess that's one of my contributions towards archaeology and discovering ancient advanced technology. And it actually, George, it was by accident, completely by accident, that I discovered the cone-shaped tools. And the reason I say this is when I first started to walk and explore the stone circles here in around my little town, the little mountainous town of Waterfallbuffen, or above the waterfall, that's what it means in Dutch, the original Dutch, Waterfallbuffen. And I started to walk and explore the stone circles in my area and the mountains around me. In the first 6 months, I walked through about 1,000 stone ruins. And that brings me back to, you know, the significance and how far back it goes and how many stone circles there are. So I thought, well, if I can walk through 1,000 stone circles in 6 months, there must be at least 100,000 of these. And then I started to count them, and I realized that there's a lot more than that. There's 10 million or more. But the cone-shaped tools became significant because in among the stone circles and the mountains, I started to pick up these weird cone-shaped stones. And to anyone that starts to look at, you know, tools and artifacts and archaeological stuff, they jump out like a sore thumb. So I started to collect and bring them to my little museum that I started in 2008. That has now grown, by the way, to a museum of, you know, hundreds, possibly over 1,000 artifacts on display, like I mentioned. And I brought these cone-shaped tools to the museum, not realizing that what I was actually collecting weren't cone-shaped tools. They were actually fossilized and petrified spikes and teeth and claws from dinosaurs and other extinct creatures. But among them were a few that could be defined as actual cone-shaped tools. But it's the fossilized body parts that made me call them cone-shaped tools. And then I started to research cone-shaped tools in history, and I realized that every ancient culture and civilization was fascinated and has very explicit images and statues and carvings of people in ancient times holding cone-shaped tools, using cone-shaped tools, healing with cone-shaped tools, mining with cone-shaped tools, and doing a whole bunch of stuff with cone-shaped tools in their hands. And then I realized it goes, you know, from the Sumerians to England to Northern Europe to the Americas, North America, the Mayas, through South America, obviously Southern Africa, to Australia, cone-shaped tools in every bloody ancient civilization. So it was by accident I thought that the petrified teeth and spikes and horns were cone-shaped tools, only to realize later that they were actually petrified body parts.
No.
It's an interesting accidental discovery, yeah.
Do you think the cone shape itself has any significance in terms of doing something?
Oh, absolutely. So this is where you start to connect the cone-shaped tools to the torus stones, those donut-shaped stones that I've been collecting, that I've, you know, spoken about before. The most, I guess, famous story at the moment is when I was on my way to Hawaii to do a presentation to Nassim Haramein many years ago now. I think it was in 2013. My partner at the time and I were invited to go and do a lecture presentation to Nassim in Hawaii and Kauai and his team of researchers there. And from what I was told, I was the first independent researcher to be invited to come and do a presentation to them. At the time, I thought I better bring Nassim a significant gift. So I took the best Torah stone that I had in the museum. I threw it in my bag and wrapped it up, and we flew off to Hawaii via Doha, Qatar.
Hold on right there, Michael. We're going to take a break. We'll pick up the story when we come right back. Next hour, we'll take your calls with Michael Tellinger as we're talking about the ancients, vanished civilizations as well. Where do they go, by the way? We'll get into some of that when we come back in a moment. Welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Michael Tellinger. He is live in South Africa. Michael, we're talking about the shape of these tool cones and if they had any significance in what they did, and the break got us. Go ahead.
Yeah, so before I continue and finish that story of the Torah stone that was on its way to Nassim Haramein in Hawaii.
Okay.
The connection between the Torah stones, the donut-shaped stones, and the cone-shaped tools is in the shape and the flow of energy that's generated by the donut-shaped tools, the donut-shaped stones. If you look at schematics and drawings of how toroidal fields work, So the donut-shaped stones is a toroidal field energy generator. That's as simple as that. And you know, we've measured it. We know which way the energy flows. We have thermal imaging cameras that show you how the one side, the energy is drawn and sucked in from the one side, so it's blue, and it pushes out the other side, so it's red. There's like a 20 degrees Celsius difference from the one side to the other side. So we know exactly how the torus stones work. Now, we had no idea 10 years ago. Even 3 years ago, we didn't know that. So we keep discovering more and more of the how this technology actually works, and how magnetic fields work. Actually, is a clear indicator how magnetic fields work and how balanced toroidal magnetic fields and electromagnetic fields work. So if you look at the way the energy flows into the torus stone and into the toroidal vortex, it flows in a cone shaped like a V-shaped cone. So the two are inextricably connected, the shape of the cone-shaped tools and the way that energy flows in and out of toroidal fields or torus stones is in a cone kind of shape. So that's really important for people to grasp and visualize that. And in fact, that's why when you say vortex energy, the V is actually indicating of a cone, right? So even that, and the other important thing is, so when people talk about vortex fields, angular momentum, torsion fields, magnetic fields, and scalar energy, all those actually refer to toroidal fields and magnetic fields that have those donut-shaped structures. So there I was in 2013 on my way to Nassim, and I threw one of these torus stones, the best one, in my bag as a present for him. And then we go via Qatar, Doha, and the plane suddenly gets delayed. No reason why. And after about a 20-minute delay, I get hauled off the plane with five guys with guns around my back.
Jeez.
And as I'm going down, you know, that arm, the walkway arm that you normally walk into an airplane with is gone. There's just a metal staircase down to the tarmac with five guys with guns around my bag. And as the moment I saw that, I went, oh, my God, that's the stone in my bag. And then I started to sweat. And I must tell you, that was unquestionably the scariest moment of my life ever.
What did they want? Did they think you had weapons?
I don't know what they thought. Well, actually, I realized what they thought only afterwards. It took me about 2 years to get out of the post-traumatic shock syndrome. Because I tell you, George, as I was walking down those stairs, I was thinking, okay, what I say in the next 30 seconds is going to determine if I end up in Guantanamo Bay or if I'm going to carry on this flight.
That's right.
It was really, really scary. Because this is now American Homeland Security. Because remember, we're now on an American chartered flight, American Airlines, or it's Qatar, but it now falls under American jurisdiction already. We've gone to American customs and all that stuff, you know? So I open the bag, I go down and I say to them, I think you're interested. It's probably the stone. I have a strange stone in my bag. And I open my bag and I lift up my clothes and I pull out the stone wrapped up in bubble wrap. And I showed them the stone, and I can't quite remember how I unwrapped it because I had no scissors or a knife. I just remember I sort of blacked out, and I just remember holding up the stone to them and say, "Yeah, I see it's a stone." As I was going down the stairs, I was thinking, "What am I going to say it is? I can't say it's ancient technology. I can't say it's archaeological artifacts because you need permits for that."
Right? They think you were stealing it or something.
Exactly. What am I going to say that is? So it just suddenly hit me. It's, it's African arts and crafts. African arts and crafts. Yes, that's an easy way out. It's non-threatening. Everybody's got these. It's a simple thing. You buy this at the African market. African art. So that's what I said. Oh, it's African arts and crafts. It's a present from my friend in Hawaii. You can't lie about it. You can't say it's a present for somebody in New York. And they asked, well, who in New York? And then you have to Guantanamo Bay because you're lying to them, right? You've got to really tell the truth without giving out away too much detail.
Exactly. So they let you go, I trust, right?
Yeah. So I held it up, and they looked at it for about 10 seconds, and then they said, okay, thanks. I put the stone back, and my bag went up to, you know, back on the plane. I went up the stairs, and when I sat down next to my partner, she said, you know, while you were down there, the captain came out, and he stood there looking at all this, and he was furious. He wanted to take off. He said if the plane doesn't take off in the next 2 minutes, he's offloading the plane. And he said whatever was in that bag crashed the TSA security system. The captain told us.
Huh.
So we now know that they knew that there was some advanced technology in the bag, but they didn't want to let out that they knew. So they just wanted to check that it is what they thought it was. And I'll tell you how I know this.
And they let you go. They let you go with it, or did they confiscate it? Okay.
Yeah, they didn't confiscate it, and they also didn't make a scene about it. They just wanted to check that it was what they thought it was. And the reason I know this is because you know when you go through an airport and you get flagged down the side and they take your bag and they open it. What do? They take everything out of your bag. They check every stitch. They check every pocket. They check everything in your bag, right?
That's right.
And they didn't do that. I literally took the clothes off the top, showed them the stone. They looked at it. I put it back, and we carried on. So they were obviously told what to look for. And when they found what they were told what to look for, they were okay, and we carried on. It took me 2 years to figure that out because I was so traumatized by this whole situation.
When you came back on the plane, Michael, I'm curious to see what the people who were the passengers looked like when they saw you coming back.
Well, they didn't really know what was going on. You know, they just, and I was shocked. I can't even remember looking at anybody. I was completely shaking and traumatized. And I just sat down and my partner said, oh, the captain said that whatever was in the bag crashed the TSA security system. And I just went, oh my God, TSA Homeland Security just gave us scientific proof that the Taurus stones are ancient advanced technology. That's the only thing I was thinking.
Let's talk a little bit about stone circles. What are the stone circles, and do they have any healing modalities to them?
Yeah, that's a very important statement, observation, and discovery all in one. So the stone circles, obviously, as I mentioned before, the original structures have no doors and entrances, although there are many that we find that have been converted by more recent tribes, migrating tribes and so forth, that inhabited these large clusters of stone circles. They, you know, several hundred, sometimes a thousand of these stone circles, and more, and they turned it into a whole village and a community. So they would create entrances and reshape them and so forth. But the original stone circles, and there are countless drawings, not countless, but there are many drawings from the 30s already, through the 40s, 50s, and then 80s and 90s, and obviously me in more recent times, that show the original structures have no doors and entrances. And this is why we had to immediately assume that these are not built as dwellings for people or cows or any other animals. And that's when we realized that this is something else. And then 2010, for the first time, while I was actually in the USA, there was a guy that came to my museum, to the Stone Circle Lodge and Museum, and a friend of mine took him out to the Stone Circles, and he had some very advanced technology with him, measuring devices that measures frequencies, electromagnetic fields, magnetic fields, all that kind of stuff. And he was the first guy to measure these powerful sound frequencies in the gigahertz, magnetic fields, and the very powerful electromagnetic fields coming out of the walls of these stone circles. So then it became very evident that these are energy-generating machines and devices. And that information obviously just grew and grew, and we measured more and more of it. So we now know without a shadow of doubt that the stone circles are advanced technology, very basic advanced technology that generate magnetic and electromagnetic fields and sound frequencies, obviously. The one creates the other. So it starts with sound. And the moving sound creates a magnetic field in the walls of the stone walls, and then those moving magnetic fields then create the electromagnetic field. So you pick up, we measure all three of those, sound frequencies, magnetic fields, and electromagnetic fields. And the important thing is that how does it work? People ask, well, how does it generate this energy? And this is the absolute ingenious understanding of the Anunnaki, because at this stage, everything seems to point to the Anunnaki and Enki that was responsible for this. There is some possibility that they may have picked up on this and then just reconstructed it or built more of it, because they realized what was going on. So it could have been another group of beings before the Anunnaki, but it's definitely Anunnaki involved in this. The way the stone circles are structured is that they are built, each stone circle is built on the cymatic pattern of the sound frequency that comes out of the earth at that point. I don't know if you get what I'm saying, George.
I do, but where did these people go? They just simply vanished.
Well, it's a very, very important question. I'm sure you deal with this question with a lot of your guests and speakers and researchers. That question remains unanswered. You know, did they go somewhere else, or did they just retreat into the mountainous areas of the inhospitable, unreachable areas of the world that we can't get to, but they can get there easily because they got the kind of crafts and technology to get there easily? It's difficult to say. I don't know. It's possible that they're still here. They never really left.
How many of them do you think there were as a civilization? 100? 10,000? What do you think?
Again, I guess we're going to be speculating when we fall back onto what some of the translations of Zachariah Sitchin tells us. And so the according to Sitchin's work, there were a few hundred of them, first a few dozen, then a few hundred, and then maybe they ended up just literally a few thousand. But it also seems that many of them started to procreate with the Earthlings.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, how many more millions were born after that? And were those the men of renown, you know, when the sons of the gods saw the daughters of man? Is that the story of the Anakim or the Anunnaki or the Elohim coming to copulate and procreate with the human females? That remains very murky and very blurry. What is not blurry and not murky is the technology. So that is very clear, and the sun circles. We can't wish them away. We got 10 million or more. We got the tools, the artifacts, the cone-shaped tools, the donut-shaped stones, the technology, and there's a holy trinity of technologies here, actually, that can be echoed and found in all ancient civilizations. And then some civilizations have interesting additions to the technologies that we find in southern Africa. And so those are the cone-shaped tools. The torus stones, the donut-shaped stones, the toroidal stones, the torus stones. And then finally are the magnetrons, the magnetron-shaped ruins. So some of the stone circles generate energy by the walls are built on the shape of the sound, of the cymatic pattern, or the shape of the sound that comes out of the earth at that specific place. Many of your listeners will be aware of the fact, you know, what cymatics is when you put sand on a metal plate, or the study of sound manifesting into physical form. So when you put sand on a metal plate, you put a sound frequency to it. Every specific sound frequency has its very unique specific shape. And that's exactly what the stone circles are. The higher the frequency, the smaller the shape, and the smaller and the more dense the pattern. The lower the frequency, the larger the pattern is. So this is why the stone circles are generally a specific size. They sort of range between a few meters across to 50 meters or sometimes 100 meters across. But when they're 100 meters, it's often a cluster of stone circles. So I think the largest stone circle we actually found to date is probably about maybe 60 meters across. And that tells us that it's a very low frequency that is the cause and the source for the shape and the size of that stone circle. And what Nikola Tesla did by using the frequency of the earth to generate energy, that's exactly what these guys did. So I think Tesla just rediscovered what these guys were doing 300,000 years ago here in southern Africa by using the vibration and the frequency of the earth to generate free energy. And that's exactly what these sound circles are. So we're looking at free energy devices. It's quite spectacular.
It almost sounds Egyptian, Michael, and I don't know which came first.
Well, Egyptian is just up the road from us. 8,000 kilometers or 9,000 kilometers north of us. keep in mind that Adam's calendar, which is sort of the flagship among the sound circles, Adam's calendar, Great Zimbabwe, and the Great Pyramid of Giza are all aligned on the same 31 degrees east longitudinal line.
That's remarkable. That doesn't come by accident.
Exactly. So we know that whoever structured those three did it on purpose They were in that line for a very specific reason. Why, I have not been able to figure out yet why it is on that longitudinal line. But these are some of the most important sites in ancient archaeological discoveries. The Great Pyramid of Giza is obviously very famous. Great Zimbabwe is less famous. And Adam's Calendar is hardly known, but it's becoming very famous because the people that do come to Adam's Calendar freak out. You know, they say the words people describe is, this is the mother lode. This is the big one. This is the most important one, and things like that. And yet, compared to the Great Pyramid or Great Zimbabwe or you know, the Mayan Pyramid, it's nothing. Even Stonehenge is more impressive than Adam's Calendar.
Let's talk about Adam's Calendar when we come back in a moment, Michael. We're going to take a quick break. And you wrote a book called Adam's Calendar as well. Michael Tellinger with us. Plus, we'll take your phone calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM.